Turn to Matthew chapter 5. We are continuing our verse-by-verse exposition of the book of Matthew. We are talking about the Sermon on the Mount currently, and we are in the section of the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus is contrasting what has been said in the law to what he now says, and we've been discussing the implications of it. I believe that Jesus is contrasting what the law of Moses said at Mount Sinai to the standards that he is now putting in place as the new lawgiver, as the establisher of the newer, higher, better covenant, built on better promises and a better blood with a better priesthood and a better end result, which is rather than condemnation by the law, salvation by the blood of Christ in the new covenant. I am convinced that what Jesus is doing in this portion of the Sermon on the Mount is that he is talking to Pharisees, Israelites, folks who were under the law, and saying to them, if you could indeed establish your own self-righteousness by your own works and your own activity of the flesh, then this is what you would have to do. This is what it would look like. And so he raised a standard that, as Wolfgang pointed out for the last 2 weeks, is an impossible standard. It's a standard that is impossible for human beings to actually achieve. But that's the point. He's doing this on purpose to level the playing field. In fact, he summarized it by saying, your righteousness has to exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees. And so it's pretty clear who the target audience is and why he's saying what he's saying. He's saying it in order to make everybody recognize that they cannot, by the law and by their flesh, by their works, they cannot achieve righteousness. And so that's going to, of course, give him the platform from which he can explain, you need me, you need a savior, you need an intercessor, you need an advocate with the Father. But first you have to understand your desperate estate in front of the Father in order to understand that you need a savior. That is why Jesus made the point of saying that healthy people, well men, don't go looking for a doctor. Only when you know you're sick will you seek a physician. Only when you know that you're in desperate trouble with the God who made heaven and earth will you go look for a solution to that problem. And Jesus is the solution. Now, when we began talking about these contrasts that Jesus set up, you've heard it said, but I say, you've heard it said, but I say, I mentioned to you that there is an interpretation of those contrasts out there. And the interpretation is that Jesus was simply explaining, extrapolating on the original meaning of the law itself. In other words, there is an understanding of these passages that says when Jesus said, you've heard it said, you shall not kill, but I say, if you hate your brother in your heart, you're guilty as a murderer, that what he was doing was explaining to the Pharisees and the lawyers and the Sadducees that they should have understood this from the law to begin with. That when they heard, thou shall not kill, they should have understood that that included, and don't hate your brother in your heart. Or that when he said, you have heard it said, don't commit adultery, but I say, lust after a woman in your heart, you've committed adultery with her in your heart. And so the philosophy, the interpretation goes that what Jesus was saying was, you should have understood from the beginning that that's what that law meant. Once it said, don't commit adultery, what it meant was, don't even lust in your heart. I have argued from the beginning of talking about these contrasts that that's not what Jesus is doing. And I am convinced that's not what he's doing because of what we're about to read from the remaining three contrasts. And I think we're going to get to all three. It took us 1 week to get through don't kill. It took us 1 week to get through don't commit adultery. But I think we can get the remaining three this morning. What is that look, Joni? I see that. I'm up here. I see every face in the room. If you make a face, I'm going to see it. Fine, place your bets. Apparently, Joni's holding the bets. But I think we can get through the three, because I think by now we see the pattern. We understand the pattern. And it's going to become exceedingly clear as we look at these three that Jesus cannot be simply explaining what the law originally meant, because now he's going to say the opposite of what the law says. So it can't possibly be an extrapolation. It can't be a definition or a clarification of the law. He is actually contrasting what he says to what the law says. For instance, start in verse 33. Tom, do me a favor. Look up Numbers 30, verse 2. Jamie, look up Deuteronomy 23, and you're going to read verses 21, 22, and 23 for us. Verse 33 of Matthew 5 says, "Again, you have heard that the ancients were told, 'You shall not make false vows, but you shall fulfill your vow to the Lord.'" You've heard it said, it's part of the law. We're about to look at it out of Numbers and out of Deuteronomy. It is stated twice. If you make a vow to God, make sure you pay your vow. So let's start with Tom reading from Numbers 30, verse 2, which will say exactly that.
"If a man vows a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by a pledge, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth."
So there it is. Jesus is accurate in saying, you've heard it said, if you vow a vow, keep your vow. Let's read from Deuteronomy 23:21-23, Jamie, nice and loud so everybody can hear you.
"When thou shalt vow a vow unto the Lord thy God, thou shalt not slack to pay it. For the Lord thy God will surely require it of thee, and it would be sin in thee. But if thou shalt forbear to vow, it shall be no sin in thee. That which is gone out of thy lips shalt thou keep and perform, even a freewill offering according as thou hast vowed unto the Lord thy God, which thou hast promised with thy mouth."
So now he's saying everything that God has required of you, do. But then if you vow beyond that, if you make an oath beyond that, if you go beyond that, make sure you do that too. Now, Moses in the Deuteronomical law does say, and if you don't make an extra oath or a vow, that's okay. That's no sin to you. But if you do make the vow, make sure that you keep the vow, or it's a sin for you not to keep your vow. Well, over the course of time then, as part of making these vows, they became a matter of oaths. I could make an oath to Conrad, for instance, where I would promise him that I would do a certain thing or be a certain place, and then I would give him some sort of keepsake to establish the vow. In fact, if you want to see a good example of that, turn to Deuteronomy 24:13. Let's all turn there for just a second. I want to show you something really interesting. Deuteronomy 24, keep your finger there in Matthew. And we'll actually start at verse 10. Verse 10 of Deuteronomy 24, "When you make your neighbor a loan of any sort, you shall not enter his house to take his pledge." See that word pledge? Basically what that means is if you'd given a loan to somebody, you would pick up collateral. You would take collateral against the loan. He says, go take the pledge, and usually the pledge was, just that you understand, it would usually be a cloak. Now, there were two pieces of clothing that the Israelites would wear in that desert area. They wore their robes, but they also had a cloak, and the cloak served two purposes. The cloak was used during the day to keep the sun off of them. Have you ever seen Bedouins in the desert? And you would think they'd be walking through the desert in bathing suits. And instead you see them in these robes with their heads covered, which seems counterintuitive, but it works because it keeps the sun off them and creates shade around them. Well, that was what the cloak did. But at night in the Middle East, especially in the desert, it gets very cold, and the cloak keeps you warm. So if you go and take a pledge, you shall remain outside And the man to whom you made the loan will bring the pledge out to you. And if he is a poor man, you shall not sleep with his pledge. In other words, by the end of the day, you have to give that pledge that you're holding from him. You have to give that back to him if he's a poor man, because he's not going to have any other way to keep himself warm. Verse 13, when the sun goes down, you shall surely return the pledge to him that he may sleep in his cloak and bless you. And it will be righteousness for you before the Lord your God. So this is that concept of making an oath and giving a pledge. Well, in place of the pledge, people were known to make an oath and then swear by something. Now, that's not just an old thing. That's something we do to this very day. Have you ever heard yourself make a promise so desperately that you've said, I swear to God? Okay, that's the same idea. I'm going to do it, and I'm not just promising you I'm going to do it. I swear to God. I heard somebody once say, I swear on my mother's grave, which I thought was very weird. But that's a way of saying, my pledge is going to be my love for my dead mother, or my belief in God, or I'm swearing by something else. I am using some other object as the pledge to prove to you the veracity of my promise to you. Got the idea? Okay, so Jesus does say back in Matthew 5, you've heard it said, don't make a false vow. Fulfill your vows to the Lord. That is exactly what the law says. If you make a vow, fulfill your vow. But I say to you, don't make any vows. Okay, that's the opposite. That is not a clarification of the law. In the law, it said, you can make a vow, and if you do, make sure you keep it. Jesus said, don't make vows. Verse 34, but I say to you, make no oath at all. And then, as was common among the Israelites, they would say, I swear by heaven, or I swear by Jerusalem. And so now he goes down the list and says, don't make any oath either by heaven, because that's the throne of God. Okay, that's really interesting. Because Jesus is now saying, how dare you use something that doesn't belong to you as collateral for your promises, especially the throne room of God. You don't own that. You have no control over that. And you certainly don't use that as the vindication or verification of how true your word is. Then he says, and don't swear by the earth, for it is the footstool of God's feet. And don't swear by Jerusalem, because it is the city of the great king. In other words, none of these things belong to you. You have no control over them. So don't be making oaths using these things as the basis for your promises. But then look at verse 36. Anybody then would say, okay, then I can't use heaven. Got it. Can't use the earth. God's footstool. Can't use it. Got it. Okay, fair enough. I'll use what I do have. I'll swear by me. I swear by my own head. Look what he says in verse 36. Nor shall you make an oath by your head, because you can't even make one hair white or black. In other words, you're not in control of you or your head. My beard has been getting progressively whiter as the years have gone by. This is a distressing reality. I look in the mirror every day, and it's a reminder that I'm not in control. Anybody here been sick lately? Yeah, did you wanna? Did you get up one day and say, I'm thinking flu. See if I can pull that off. No, well, that's a sure example that you are definitely not in control. I, last week, turned 59. 59 years old. Oh, I'm sorry, I can't do that anymore. I'm sorry, I was exhorted by letter from one of our elder statesmen who pointed out that, how old was Tony Martin when you heard him sing?
86.
He was 86, and you pointed out that Tony Bennett is 88 and still singing.
Probably 89 by now.
Still up there singing in his 80s, and so he said, I'm not allowed to make any more old pastor jokes. So, okay. But I'm 59, is my point. And I can look back over the course of my life, and I recognize that every bad thing that ever happened to me, I typically didn't see coming. I wasn't ready for it. I wasn't prepared for it. Just came in like a freight train and bowled me over. Just some terrible thing, some horrible news, some disastrous thing has happened. And I usually didn't see it coming. I got blindsided as often as not. And every really good and great and wonderful thing that has ever happened to me happened despite me. It wasn't me that did it. Something great would just happen, some wonderful blessing, something would come along, and I go, this is great, oh, this is good. I didn't make this happen, I couldn't have made this happen, and yet this wonderful thing happened. Well, put all those pieces together, it's clear that I'm not in control. I couldn't stop my hair from falling out, but it did, and I could not control it. I did reach the point where I quit washing it because I figured when it fell out, it could just take the dirt with it. But no, that's a joke. No. But that happened. And so Jesus uses that example and says, you can't even stop your hair from turning white. So you don't own you. You're not in charge of your head. You're not in charge of heaven. You're not in charge of the earth. You're not in charge of Jerusalem. You're not in charge of you. So you have nothing by which you can swear. You can't use any of these as a surety of your oath. So then, how should you be? Verse 37, let your statement be yes for yes or no for no. Anything beyond that is of the evil one. In other words, just be a person of your word. If you say yes, it's yes. If you say no, it's no. But you don't need to swear by heaven, and you don't need to swear by God, and you don't need to swear by your own head, because you don't own any of those. You're not in control of any of those. God is sovereign over all those things. You just be a person of your word. Now, by the way, I point out again, that is not what the law says. The law says, go ahead and make oaths. Just make sure that you pay your oath. Whatever you swear by, make sure that you pay up on whatever it is you swore by. But Jesus says, don't make oaths. It's the opposite. Okay, now he's going to get even more opposite. Verse 38. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That's a very common phrase. We know that phrase well. Tom, look up Exodus 21:24. Everybody else go to Leviticus 24:20, except Jamie, who's going to look up Deuteronomy 19:21. Leviticus 24:20 is everybody else. This is a rule that shows up repeatedly in the law. Leviticus 24:20 for everybody else. Tom is going to read for us Exodus 21:24, but look closely at it. I think the verse before it would be helpful. Let's read both of those.
But if there is harm, then you shall pay life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe.
Okay, so that's the standard of the law. Whatever is done to a person that harms them, that same thing is done to the person who harmed them. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Is everybody in Leviticus 24? Let's start at verse 17. We'll read through verse 23. If a man takes the life of any human being, he shall surely be put to death. That's life for life. And the one who takes the life of an animal shall make it good, life for life. In other words, if you kill somebody's goat, you have to give them a goat. And if a man injures his neighbor, just as he has done, so it shall be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, just as he has injured a man, so it shall be inflicted on him. Thus, the one who kills an animal shall make it good, but the one who kills a man shall be put to death. There should be one standard for you. It shall be for the stranger as well as for the native, for I am the Lord your God. And Moses spoke to the sons of Israel, and they brought the one who had cursed outside the camp. They stoned him with stones. Thus the sons of Israel did, just as the Lord commanded Moses. In other words, they took this very seriously, very literally. It was eye for eye, it was tooth for tooth, it was life for life, animal for animal. There was an equity to the law. It's a very rational rule. And in fact, these days in America, we still believe in some corners of America in the death penalty. If you kill somebody, you need to die. That's that same concept. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, life for life. Jamie, you are going to read Deuteronomy 19:21 for us, which will say the same thing. I'm just showing that in Exodus, when the law was first handed out, the eye for eye, tooth for tooth rule was laid out. In the Levitical law, it's laid out. In the Deuteronomical law, it's laid out. This is a well-known standard. Yes, Jamie.
And thine eye shall not pity, but life shall go for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot.
Now, the reason that phrase is important is that God adds via Moses, and no pity. This is a standard. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. If someone does something wrong, they get an equitable punishment that is equal to how they harmed the other person. That's what the law says. Are we clear about that now? Okay, it's a very clear rule. Can you see why when Jesus said, you've heard it said, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, they would go, yeah, that one we've heard. In fact, we've heard it over and over. Okay, so now back to Matthew 5. Matthew 5, verse 38. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. I'm going to say one more time, just parenthetically here. This is the place where when I studied this 20 years ago, this is the place where my mind turned. Because this is the one that I couldn't possibly explain as Jesus simply extrapolating on the law and saying what you should have understood was this. This was essential to my understanding of Old Covenant, New Covenant distinctions. It was a real starting place for me. You've heard it said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Verse 39, but I say to you, do not resist him who is evil, and whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn and give him the other one also. How in the world do you get turn the other cheek from eye for eye, tooth for tooth? You don't. You can't. There's simply no way to say, you know what the Pharisees should have understood. Because we read it three different places. It's in Exodus, it's in Leviticus, it's in Deuteronomy, and it's without pity, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, equitable justice, straight down the line. And Jesus says, but I say to you, if somebody hits you on the right cheek, give them your left cheek too, and don't withstand evil people. What? Wait, that's not the same. And so this was the beginning of my understanding. Okay, what Jesus is really doing here is establishing himself as the new lawgiver, and his law is different, and his law is better, and his law is more difficult, and his standard is much higher. But he doesn't stop at turn the other cheek. Look at the next thing that he says. Remember what we read from Deuteronomy 24:13 a little while ago. That even if somebody gave you their cloak as a pledge, you had to give them back that cloak at the end of the day so that they could sleep because it'd be too cold without it. You had to take pity on them and give them back their cloak. That's how important your cloak was. Look what Jesus says. If anyone sues you to take the NASB says shirt, terrible word. Robe, your undergarment, the main garment that everybody wore, the robe, and then they would put their cloak over it, and the cloak is what kept you safe from the sun and safe from the cold. Cloak is very important for staying alive in the Middle Eastern desert region. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, then give him your cloak also. If they want the lesser thing, the robe, Give them the greater thing. Give them the cloak too. That is not eye for eye, tooth for tooth. It's the opposite. Don't withstand the evil person. If he slaps you, let him slap you again. And if he tries to take your robe, give him your cloak too. Really? You want this? Well, you can have all this. Wait, he goes further. Verse 41. And whoever shall force you to go 1 mile with him, then go with him 2 miles. That's where you get the phrase, go the extra mile. Have you ever heard that phrase? I'm going to go the extra mile. That's a biblical phrase. It means that if somebody compels you to go with them some distance, don't just do the least amount they require of you. Do more than people require of you. Go the extra mile. Go above and beyond. If they slap you, let them slap you again. If they sue you for your robe, give them the cloak. If they compel you to walk a mile, walk an extra mile. That is not eye for eye, tooth for tooth. It is directly the opposite. It is be good to your enemies. And if someone is out to hurt you, rather than take vengeance against them, you recognize that God has already said, vengeance is mine, says the Lord. I will recompense. And you recognize that God is your security and that it's God that gave you your coat and your cloak in the first place. If he gave you that one, he can give you another one. Okay, why? Why are you doing all this kindness to your enemies? Why are you not resisting evil people? Well, Jesus is going to explain it. And his explanation is so high and so grand that there's no way it could have been said in the law. The law could only say, you're guilty, and here's equity, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. What the law could not do, we read over and over again, it could not make you righteous. It could not make you holy. It could not make you good. And it could not justify you in the sight of God. But look at what Jesus says. Verse 41, whoever shall force you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles, and then give to him who asks of you. Don't turn away from those who want to borrow from you. There's two things going on in that verse. One is somebody's just begging. I need a handout. I need help. Jesus says, well, then help. If someone asks you for help, help them. Don't turn away. And if someone asks you for a loan, then go ahead and give them the loan. Be good to people. This all falls under the category of be good to people, but not just your friends. Be good to your enemies as well. Then he goes further. Look at verse 43. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Okay, now that particular phrase, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, isn't found anywhere in the Old Testament, but certainly the concepts are. Both of those ideas are there. For instance, here we go again, Tom, Leviticus 19, 18, and the rest of us are going to go to Deuteronomy 23. So Deuteronomy 23 for all of us. Now, you know that when Jesus was confronted by the Pharisees, they asked him, what is the great commandment? They wanted to know what the greatest of the commandments was. And I think you see in the language that they sort of expected one of the 10. They expected something chiseled in stone. And he said, the foremost, the greatest commandment, is you will love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your mind, and your strength. And then he said, and the second is like it, you will love your neighbor as yourself. And when he said that, he went far away from the Ten Commandments and just went to a rule that was written in the book of Leviticus 19:18. Read that for us, Tom.
You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord.
Okay, now watch this. You're going to read it again, but I want you to read the verse before it and after it.
You shall not hate your brother in your heart, but you shall reason frankly with your neighbor, lest you incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself, I am the Lord. You shall keep my statutes. You shall not let your cattle breed with a different kind. You shall not sow your field with two kinds of seed, nor shall you wear a garment of cloth made of two kinds of material.
Now, the reason I had to read that is that there are no verses or verse markers or enumeration in the original writing. It just leapt right from love your neighbor as yourself to don't interbreed animals, don't wear cloth that's made out of two things, and don't put two different kinds of seed in your field. And so it's in a fairly innocuous place in the law. But Jesus went and grabbed that phrase from the middle of all that and said, that's the second greatest command right there. So again, what was he doing? The Pharisees say, what's the greatest commandment? They're expecting one of the ten. Probably something like, you'll have no other gods before me, or don't make an idol, or something like that. That's what they're expecting. And he says, the great commandment, and he reaches over to a completely separate place. The great commandment is, you'll love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the second is like it. And he goes to there. Love your neighbor as yourself. In this is all the law and the prophets. He summarizes the law and the prophets by those two phrases. And yet, I point out, that phrase was in a very sort of interesting, almost obscure place. Why? Because Jesus took the thing that they saw as being just another passing sort of secondary rule, and he advanced it and said, no, this is now a primary rule. Because he's the new lawgiver. He can establish any new rule he wants. Is everybody in Deuteronomy 23? We will start in, well, right at the top. We'll start at verse 3. No Ammonite or Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord, none of their descendants, even to the 10th generation, shall ever enter the assembly of the Lord. Because they did not meet you with food and water on the way when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam the son of Beor from Pethor of Mesopotamia to curse you. Nevertheless, the Lord your God was not willing to listen to Balaam, but the Lord your God turned the curse into blessings for you because the Lord your God loves you. You shall never seek their peace or their prosperity all your days. Okay, that's the hate your enemies part. That's the part where he says, these are your enemies. They weren't good to you when you came out, and so don't seek their peace and don't seek their prosperity. And in fact, they can never be a part of the assembly of Israel, or the assembly of the Lord, because they're enemies of God and they're your enemies, so treat them that way. Okay, that's what the law says. It says, love your neighbors, hate your enemies. Right? Okay, verse 43 of Matthew 5. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemy and pray for those who persecute you. Is it worth pointing out again that that is the opposite of what the law says? The law says, love your neighbor, hate your enemy. Jesus says, love your enemy. It's the exact opposite. Now, it's really tough. I admit, it's really tough. Especially when you go back and you read the Psalms. You heard what, rather providentially, Todd read for us this morning out of the Psalms. I mean, even David would write oftentimes that God would go and smite his enemies and keep him safe. But go get my enemies, because they're your enemies too. Go get them, God. Jesus comes along, the son of David, and says, pray for those that spitefully use you. That's not the same. Are you getting a feel for this? I just want to keep pointing out that the interpretation of these contrasts that says Jesus was simply explaining what the Pharisees should have always understood from the law is a faulty interpretation, because if you look at the words on the page, there's no way that's what Jesus was doing. He was establishing himself as the new lawgiver, handing out newer, higher, better, more difficult rules for his people. And, as I said earlier, in so doing, he was leveling the playing field. Because let's test this. How many of you love your enemies? Okay, tough one, right? Tough, really hard. Okay, what if the standard for entrance into God's heaven is we test to see whether you loved your enemies? Uh-oh. Uh-oh. Well, we know one guy's out. I mean, what are we going to do? What if that really is the standard? What if Jesus is telling the truth and this is what righteousness really looks like? We're all in just such deep trouble. But we're all in deep trouble anyway, and that's the point. That's why Jesus keeps leveling the playing field. That's why Jesus keeps pointing out that if you could indeed be righteous in and of yourself by your flesh, this is what it would look like. When somebody hit you in the right cheek, you'd give them the left. If they sued you for your robe, you'd give them the cloak. You'd constantly go the extra mile. You would love your enemies. I hate you. I hate you. I want to hurt you. I hate you and I hate your family and I hate everything you stand for and I hate what you believe. Those aren't the people we typically embrace. Oh, come here. Bring it in. Come here. Noogies. You. I love you. No, I don't feel warm and fuzzy about those people. In fact, I'm as likely to say, get them, God. They hate me, they hate you, they hate your word, they hate Christ. Get them, God. But then I'm reminded that, and this is the essential point, God is going to get them. The fact that they are able to rebel against God here and now is not proof that they will always get away with it. Death is, after all, the final judgment. And everybody dies once, and then the judgment. And they're going to stand in front of the God of ages, who, by the way, is able to exact his vengeance in ways that are far superior to how you can exact your vengeance. I mean, what's the worst that Micah can do to somebody? Really? April, what do we think? What's the worst that Micah can really dole out? I mean, he might be able to say some harsh words. Maybe if he gets really mad enough at you, he'll punch you in the nose, you know? If he really flips out, maybe he'll hurt you bad. I don't think he has the capacity to go after somebody to kill him. I just don't think that's in Micah. But let's say Micah really got steamed. He really got upset. We said something that just, that was it. He just couldn't take it anymore. He's out for vengeance. What can he really do? You know, Jesus said, don't fear man who can only kill the body. Fear God who can cast body and soul into hell. Okay, that's a much more dramatic vengeance. Because any vengeance that Micah doles out is just a temporary vengeance. It's time bound. We're going to get over it. The bruises are going to heal. The bloody nose will quit running after a while. But if God meets out vengeance against you, there's no return from that. The great eternal God has said, vengeance is mine, I will recompense. And so on that basis, we can recognize that God has already got this. It's not up to us to mete out that kind of vengeance, and that becomes our inspiration to be good to people and to be kind to people, even though we can't do it perfectly and we can't do it in such a way as to establish our own righteousness. I do think that it's a goal that we ought to at least attempt to attain. Yes, sir.
I hate to do this to you.
No, you don't.
Extreme example.
Okay.
Leon has two daughters and a son. He's a missionary in the Middle East, say. An ISIS guy comes to his home, wants to cut his son's throat and take one of his daughters. Is Leon going to say, take my other daughter too? I said it's an extreme example.
I don't think by any human reckoning that happens, but I think that's the point. I don't think we're capable of holding these standards. Every one of these standards is ridiculously high and ridiculously difficult. No, I don't need ISIS. If a guy breaks into my house and threatens my daughter, I'm not going to give him a big hug and bake him a cake and tell him how much I love. But understand the standard, Jim. Do you see where Jesus' standard is?
Higher than we can attain,
across the board. Have you ever hated your brother in your heart? Man, spoken like a lawyer. It depends what the definition of is.
I don't know if I have or not.
You've never hated anybody your whole life?
Oh, yeah, you have.
Oh, your son speaks for you. Okay, I'll make it easy. Have you ever lusted after a woman in your heart?
Yes.
Guilty. Now, what are you going to do about that? You're guilty. And you know what? The thing about guilt before the law, and this is important, the thing about guilt before the law, and far too often people who preach legalism don't seem to understand this, one miss and you're guilty of the whole law, which means the curse of the law falls on you. James writes it in the New Testament. If you're guilty of any one infraction before the law, you're guilty of the whole law, and the curse that is attendant to the law is now a curse that is on your head. And so you're guilty before the law already. That's the standard. Then Jesus comes along and raises the standard so high that it makes everybody guilty. And I think that's the whole point. I think the whole point is to say to people who thought that they could achieve their own righteousness by their works, by the works of the law, he was pointing out that if you're going to stand before God and be judged on the basis of your works, the standard is so high, you can't do it. You have to have an advocate. You have to have a savior. Somebody has to stand before you and the perfect, righteous, holy standard of God, or you fry, and rightfully so. Should we press toward this standard? Yeah. But it's easier for me to ignore an enemy on YouTube who leaves some stupid comment. That's easier than if a guy breaks into my house and is attacking my daughter. Now, there are segments of modern Christianity who are attempting to achieve genuine passivity. And they say, you don't ever go to war, you don't ever fight back, you trust that God is going to control the situation no matter what.
Quakers,
for example. Yeah, I don't know that I have that in me. But every time I think about that, it reminds me how not perfect I am, how imperfect I am, how much I have not achieved the standard. I haven't achieved the 613 rules of the old covenant law. Then Jesus narrowed them down to two. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength. Are you doing that? That's one down. Love your neighbor as yourself.
So he's slam dunking our depravity.
Slam dunking our depravity. Boy, is that a t-shirt.
Yeah. Is he illustrating to us what the government will be like when God is king?
When he returns and establishes his rule and his kingdom, then I believe that these are the kinds of standards that you're going to see not only played out as rules of judgment, but also as the standard that we're going to live by. New Jerusalem, new body, no more sin within us.
Curse removed.
Well, then I'm much more likely to act like this. So it's a goal, and it's certainly a standard that I look at. Look, I'll put it to you this way. Paul said that where the law was concerned, this is Romans 7, he said he didn't know that he was coveting until the law said, don't covet. And then he recognized that he did covet all the time. But until the rule was put in place, he didn't recognize that sin in himself. Okay? I think same thing here. I recognize now, being aware of Jesus' standards, I recognize when I start to feel animosity in my heart against somebody. I wouldn't have that recognition if I didn't know these rules. If Jesus hadn't pointed out that that is my natural tendency, I would have continued living by my natural tendency. But when Jesus points it out and says, that's wrong, Well, then I'm conscious of it, so I try not to. Now, can I achieve it perfectly? And would I want to be judged on that basis? Absolutely not. But am I conscious of it? Yeah, sure. I try to be better to people. Well, wait. Jesus is actually going to say it. Jesus will spell it out for us. He's going to explain why he said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. And by the way, this is all together with turn the other cheek, give him your cloak, go the extra mile. And these are people who are suing you. And these are people who are compelling you to go the mile. I mean, these are not friends. And then he says, you've heard it said, love your neighbor, hate your enemy. I say to you, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you, in order that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and he sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. So now Jesus is saying, if you look at how God is, if you look at his character, if you look at how he behaves, if you are indeed the sons of that God, then you will reflect that behavior. One of the things that David observed in the Psalms was that far too often the guilty go unpunished. We sing about it in the song, Farther Along, We'll Know More About It, while there are others gone on around us, never molested, though in the wrong. And so Jesus points out that God, in his goodness, in his graciousness, knowing full well that some of the people on the planet are his enemies, nevertheless sends rain in its season, and the people who are his enemies, who he knows he's going to judge, who he knows are going to fall under his condemnation, still have food, still have clothes. Some of the most wicked people on the planet right now are also the richest and most influential. That doesn't seem right. It doesn't seem just. How are we going to live with that? Well, we have to recognize that God makes his rain fall on the just and the unjust. And it's not that he has left them without punishment. He just hasn't punished them yet. And this is why they are so deceived. This is why their minds are so darkened. Here, I'll give you a great example. Okay, so, Sean, I'm going to pick on you, okay? Fair enough. Welcome to GCA. It's so good to have you here. Now I'm going to pick on you. Ever lied to your parents about anything ever? Yeah, okay, good. So he went with honest. Okay, he's not confessing to anything at this moment. Have you, in the lies that you've conspired against your parents and stuff, have you ever hidden the truth and then got away with it? Yeah, barely, but you got away, right? Okay, now let me ask you a question. When you got away with it, did that inspire you to be more honest or more dishonest because you got away with it? More dishonest? Yeah, because that's human nature. When we get away with it, we think, well, then I can continue to get away with it. And so people, human beings on the planet right now, curse God to his face, spit on his word and hate his son. And they are not judged and they are not punished. And in fact, sometimes in this evil, wicked world, they excel and they do wonderfully well. And so they assume that because they're getting away with it, then they're always going to get away with it. There must not be any punishment for this. So they just keep doing it. And God keeps sending them rain and food and clothes and building up their punishment. There's this really interesting thing that happened in the Old Testament. There are a lot of interesting things that happened in the Old Testament. A donkey talked in the Old Testament. That was interesting. But anyways, there are a lot. The reason that God said to Abraham that he was going to take his descendants into Egypt and that they were going to serve in Egypt as slaves for 400 years, and then they would be brought back to this land that God promised them and drive out the people that were in that land. And the reason God gave is, he said, because the iniquity of the Amorites isn't yet full. What? God said, these Amorites that are in your land right now, this land that I've promised you, I'm going to punish them. I'm going to use you to punish them. In fact, your descendants, who are only a few, are going to go into the land of Egypt. They're going to come out 1 million people. So I'm going to take them into Egypt, and while they're in slavery, I'm going to build them into an army. They're going to be a nation, and I'm going to bring them to Mount Sinai, and I'm going to establish them as a nation. I'm going to codify them as a nation by the law of Moses, and then I'm going to take them to that land that I've promised to you, Abraham, and they will drive out these Amorites that are living here. But I'm going to give the Amorites 400 more years to build up their iniquity against me so that when I punish them, it's a completely just punishment. So this is a God who is very long-suffering, who is very patient, and who is not slack when it comes to punishment. He's going to judge, and he's going to punish. He just hasn't done it yet. And because he's the God of eternity, he's got all the time in the world, and he can wait 400 years if he wants. Jesus was here 2,000 years ago. We read that when he comes back, he's coming back in righteousness and justice, two-edged sword out of his mouth, going to bring war in the Middle East on the Megiddo Plain. We know it as Armageddon. And that the blood is going to flow to the bridles of the horses. This is a severe judgment. 2,000 years! And every once in a while, I look at, like, ISIS. I look at what's going on in the Middle East. I look at people sawing heads off, the depravity of it, the cruelty of it, killing children, the horror of what's going on over there. And I think, where are you, Jesus? What about that two-edged sword thing? He's going to do it. He just hasn't yet. Okay, so if you know that about people, if you have an enemy, if there's somebody who is rebelling against everything that is good and godly and right, you can't judge them the way God can judge them. So, from that perspective, can you begin to see, yeah, okay, I'm going to be good to my enemies. Because ultimately, the punishment exists, and the punishment is coming, and the judgment is going to be meted out by a God who can mete out a much more severe and long-lasting punishment than I can ever mete out. And by the way, one more thing. If I mete out some kind of punishment in retaliation against Micah for punching me in the nose, I'm back to that. I haven't forgotten. I hold a grudge. If I mete out some kind of retaliation against Micah for doing that to me, who am I? Am I really so good that I ought to go to Micah and say, who do you think you are to come against me? Who am I? I'm just another sinner like he is. But when you rebel against the righteous, holy, eternal God, well, he has every right to mete out punishment. He has every right to mete out eternal, long-lasting punishment because you have sinned against and rebelled against righteousness, holiness, goodness, and the grace of God that kept you alive, fed you, and clothed you your whole life. You're guilty, and you deserve what you get. See the difference? So, Jesus says, I love this verse, verse 46. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you get? It's easy to love people who love you. I have told my daughter several times that there is nothing more attractive to a man than a woman who thinks he's attractive. Works every time. All the men in the room went, yeah, that's right, yeah. Just any woman, you can look at her and go, you know, I don't know, I don't care, I don't, you know, and she'll go, nice shirt, and you go, yeah, I know, right? You know, so that's just, that's human nature. We just immediately respond to people who like us. The most attractive people we come across are the people who like us. We're attracted back to them. So Jesus says, if you love those who love you, why would you get any kind of reward for that? That's natural, but he says, don't even the tax gatherers do the same thing? Again, throughout the New Testament, there are certain groups of people who are identified as being the worst of the worst. I think we'd all agree at this moment, tax gatherers, we don't like them now either. But IRS officials, we're not fond of them.
And,
I'm sorry, Eileen. It's the taxes itself that we. But my point being.
I don't like them either. So.
Oh, good. Okay. Good. I'm with you. Within Israel's general society, there were people like Matthew. So it's interesting that Matthew is quoting this. Matthew was a tax collector. And so if somebody sinned in the church and somebody confronted them and then came back with two or three witnesses and then took them in front of the whole assembly and they still wouldn't hear the assembly, you were to cast them out and treat them like a publican or a sinner. Sinner would have been enough, but publican, tax collector, he threw that in because people hated the tax collectors. So he says, even tax collectors love people who love them. So if you're walking around going, I'm doing pretty good, I love my brother. Well, yeah, of course, big deal. He loves you, you love him. You don't get any reward, no gold star on your forehead for that. Verse 47, and if you greet only your brethren, then what do you do that's more than anybody else? Don't the Gentiles do the same thing? Evidence again that his audience is Jews. He says, but even the Gentiles who don't have God, who don't have Moses, who don't have the covenant, who are strangers to everything that is salvation through the God of Israel, those strangers, they do the same thing you're bragging about. You walk around thinking it's good because you greet your brethren. It's a big deal. Gentiles do that. Verse 48, therefore, you are to be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. And that, I believe, is the summation of all five of these. You've heard it said, but I say. He raised the standard from semi-doable, which the law was. There were things in the law that you could do. One of the 613 rules says, if you're walking on the street and you see your neighbor's animal in a ditch, take it out of the ditch. Okay, I can do that. I feel pretty good about that. There are certain rules in the law that you could accomplish, so semi-doable. But through his five contrasts of you've heard it said, but I say, he raised the standard to ridiculously high to this is what perfection looks like, and you can't do it. But you have to be as holy as your Father because he's holy. That's the standard. If you're going to be in heaven and you're going to stand in front of God and you're going to be accepted and you're going to live eternally in his presence, you have to be as holy as he is. That's the standard. What are you going to do about that? So now the big question. Was Jesus laying out this standard so that he could say, now do it? No, I don't believe so. I think he was doing it to say, you Pharisees think that by keeping the law, you have established your own perfection. Remember, he said to them, you search the scriptures because you think in them that you have life. But they are they that testify of me. He kept saying, you keep thinking that you can do it by the law, but you can't. You can only do it by me. You need me. You have to come to the Father through me. I am the way. I'm the truth. I'm the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. And so I believe that he was pulling the rug out from under the Pharisees and the legalists, the lawyers, the Sadducees, anybody who thought that they were good enough because of the law of Moses. He said, well, this is what real holiness would look like if you could do it. Okay, now big picture, big theological picture, and we're done. You can't stand before God unless you're equally holy with God. That's a didactic statement, and you can't get around it. I want to stand in front of God and not be judged. I don't want to give account for every idle word, or I'm in big trouble. I don't want to be judged against the standard of the law of Moses, any less the standard of the new lawgiver. I don't want that. I want to be accepted before God. How do I do that? There's only one way, to be accepted in the Beloved. He loves his Son because his Son is righteous and holy and was able to say confidently, I do always those things that please the Father. And if you're in him and he's in you, if you're part of the church that is the body and bride of Christ, If you're part of the outcalled who he chose and wrote your name in the Lamb's Book of Life before the foundation of the world, if that is true of you, then when he died at Calvary, he took your sin debt and removed the curse of the law. The law can't get you. The curse is removed. But all that does is make you morally neutral. You're simply not any longer bad, but you need to be positively righteous, positively holy, as good as God is. And so Jesus' righteousness is imputed to you. This is the only way that anybody gets to stand before God and actually achieve the holiness that Jesus just said you have to have. You have to be as perfect as God is perfect to be in God's presence. And you simply cannot be that perfect because you've already blown it. And you're already guilty. And so the only way that anybody stands before God can't be by your works, can't be by your flesh, can't be by the way you will or run or choose or decide. It has to be because Christ removed your sin and your curse and then took his goodness, his righteousness, his holiness, and put it on you so that when God looks at you, he looks through those Jesus glasses where he no longer sees you, he sees his son. And he loves and adores his son, and so we are accepted in the son, in and through the finished work of Christ. This is why I keep saying to anybody, anywhere, anytime, you need Jesus.
Amen.
And when I say that, I mean you need Jesus. Every other established, respected religion in the history of planet Earth says if you want to stand before God, get busy and do something. Why are they cutting off heads? Because they think they are establishing the kingdom of Allah on the planet and that Allah is going to reward them. If they blow themselves up, they get rewards in heaven, or, you know, you hear about the 72 virgins or whatever else. It's always God responding in every religion on the planet. It is God responding to the activity of people who, if they just do enough stuff, are rewarded with heavenly destinies and presence with God.
So it puts the people in control.
It puts the people in control. Very, very good. You're the deciding factor. You're the first cause. Christianity, unique among all the religions of the history of planet Earth, Christianity admits you're not any good. And worse, the standard is so ridiculously high that you can't do it. But God, in his goodness, in his grace, in his kindness, has already provided absolutely everything necessary for your eternal well-being and salvation. And he did it all in and through his son, and then placed you in his son and his son in you, and took up residence in you via his Holy Spirit. And that Spirit is in the process of conforming you to the image of his Son, because that is what he determined and destined for you. That way, God is the first cause. God is the determining factor.
And you don't want the alternative.
And you don't want the alternative. So look, work as hard as you want. Work, work away. Work, 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 work. Work, knock yourself out. Go find some preacher who will preach works to you and legalism and work yourself to death. And you know what you get before God? Nothing, nada, zilch, zero. You've got a pile of filthy rags you're taking in front of the holy God and saying, here, I got you this. That helps with nothing. You need Jesus. You need an intercessor. You need an advocate with the Father. You need his holiness placed on your account. You need to be accepted in the Beloved One. Short of that, you're lost. I'm sorry.
You need to keep confessing your sin.
You need to keep confessing your sin. But you know what? Beyond that, Gladys, it's one thing to confess your sin, but you better also confess his goodness. Confess him, 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 him. You can spend the rest of your life gazing at your navel and saying, I really am that bad. But at some point, you better lift your eyes and say, he really is that good.
Yes.
Yeah?
Well, we've got his example to follow.
Yeah, exactly right.
I don't want to be on the cross.
No. Which is why it's so great that Paul would say that we're not ordained to a curse. We're not ordained to wrath. That has all been removed. All right, I could go on and on, as I'm sure you know, and as I often do. But I'm pleading with you. I'm begging you. If you're here today and for some reason you walked through the door of a Calvinistic church, lo-de-do-de-do, and you don't know this Jesus I'm talking about, don't leave here without knowing this Jesus. Don't leave here without taking the time to pull somebody aside, me or somebody, and say, what is this you're talking about?
You just won the lottery.
You just won the lottery. You need to know these things, and you need to know him. And if you don't, come ask. Because I got a cure for your problem. Any questions? Grace, 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 grace. Yes, sir?
If the standard was lower, more attainable by human effort, then flesh could glory before him and steal the rightful glory that belongs to Christ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we read, and no flesh will glory in his presence.
So that's why the standard has to be unattainable.
Has to be ridiculously high. Yeah.
And is the same thing as going back to the Garden of Eden when the serpent was tempted to eat?
Yeah.
It's the same thing. It's just different words, maybe.
What it is consistency in the way God is and the way God acts. In other words, this is not the theology of Paul that was unique, something he made up. This is the theology of the Bible. This is the theology of God from the beginning.
It gives you such peace of mind that God does not change, because if he did, look out.
Yeah. That's why I tell people, you are in fact secure in Christ. Because if God chose you, put you in his Son, put his Spirit inside you, and then could lose you, that's to admit that he made a mistake by choosing you in the first place. Or that he simply didn't know you were going to be that bad. He chose you and then went, well, darn, I thought I really had Alan here, you know. Yeah. You are utterly secure in the finished work of Christ.
And that's what a lot of people just can't fathom. They can't understand.
Yeah.
That's the way it has to be.
And once you get that, you just said, I mean, that lifts this huge burden off your shoulders. Can you see now why Paul would talk about the peace that passes understanding? Why are we at peace in a completely insane world?
Because I know a lot of Christians that still hold to legalism, and you can't do that.
There is no peace in legalism.
Yeah.
Because there's no end game.
Right.
There's no point at which you can say, got it, nailed it, got it, did it. It's just a nonstop succession of not yet, not yet, not good enough, not good enough. You can never rest, and you can never feel secure. There's no peace in that. But there's such sweet peace in knowing the finished work of Christ. Yes, ma'am.
I was just thinking about, this is in Judaism right now, what they call the 10 days of Allah, which is where you introspect and you think about, gee, have I really been good enough? And you hope that on Yom Kippur you're going to get a whole other year of life. You know? And it just struck me of, you know, what a bondage that is.
Absolutely.
It's just that they're serious about it.
Sure, they're serious about it. How serious about it do you have to be to cut a head off? That's pretty serious. But is it right just because it's serious? No. You can be seriously deluded.
But they can set a good example by cutting their own head off. That would be something.
Wow. Thanks, Alan, for taking it in a weird direction. Anything else?
Wednesday break.
Oh. Yes, good. Thank you. We won't be here for at least the next 3 Wednesdays for midweek services. The online voting for the next book of the Bible to go through has been fast and furious, but still there's no clear winner. So we'll see what happens.
3 more votes for Ezekiel.
How do you get to triple vote? Hey, I'm old. You're the guy who told me I wasn't allowed to use old as a reference on him. Well, in your case. said it, not me. I was agreeing. I was just loving my brother. That's all I was doing. So in any case, we won't be here for the next three, possibly four, but we'll announce it before we rev back up again. This week, my daughter and I are going to a concert on Wednesday night, so I'm excited about that. And then the next couple of weeks, Tom and I are going to go visit some of our other preaching friends, because I need a few weeks of being preached too. After 64 weeks of systematic theology, I get to go sit with friends and be preached to for a couple of weeks. So we'll be back here. Don't come this Wednesday. If you come, you'll just be in the parking lot by yourself. Anything else? All right, we're good? All right, good. Let's ask Tom to come up here. Let's all stand, and Tom will say our closing prayer for us.
Thank you for listening to this Sunday morning message from Grace Christian Assembly. Please visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. And join us next time as we gather around the Word and study God's sovereign grace.